They're in the notes, which I'll post tonight. And are we talking now? Are you talking to me? We're talking to me a little bit. I don't know if that's too little. It's like too little. They are in recordings from last year and the year before. What has tended, this is probably too much, what's tended to happen in previous recordings is that I've only got as far as the Grecian air, and so there isn't a proper recording about this poem, the last of the three poems, which is why I'm going to concentrate on it today, so that you have a recorded thing about each of them. So, you have a concept of the eternal and the ephemeral moment, and one of the relationships between those two things is stasis. Do you understand what stasis is? It sounds like the name of a Californian girl. But... Can I do it as stasis? Stasis? Right. So, a permanent state which is incapable of change. So, when Keats is talking about the nightingale's song, he's talking about the nightingale's song which Ruth heard in the fields in the Bible. Yeah? Ruth, the Bible? Ruth, whatever. Yeah. Well, and the song which has been the same since classical times to the present time. So you have the bird enjoying the moment, not aware, not some sort of magical bird like Shelley wants the bird to be, which knows all about, knows the secrets of life and death, but a more realistic bird which does not have any knowledge of death and so knows how to live the moment. To some extent for the romantics in general, but more keenly for Keats, our great blessing and our great tragedy is in language and through language, knowing that we are mortal. And so knowing that everything is changeable, everything is mutable, and so nothing good will be conserved. The only way of conserving things is through things like art, like the music of the bird, or in this Grecian urn, supposedly a vase, a vasija of some type, which has survived for thousands of years. And so the people in the illustrations on that have the joy of the moment, but they will never have the fulfillment of the moment. So you have, for example, pictures of lovers chasing each other in the fields and this sort of thing, and there's lots of sort of euphoric scenes. But he's jealous of their situation, which is permanent, being in love, being in that, but there will never be the fulfillment of that love because they're trapped in art. So what he's moving towards is a recognition that the beauty of life, the fulfillment of the beauty of life, is inextricably separated from decay and from death. Now, you might ask yourself, you might ask yourself why somebody who is 23 should be worrying about these types of things when he should be worrying about getting a car and going to discos and finding girls who can get on with, etc. Keats's life experience was very specific. He was born in the Swan and Hoop Tavern. His father was a pub owner, a tavern owner, so basically a pub with a few rooms for guests. Yeah? So, somebody who is middle class in the sense that they have a business, they have a property, etc., etc., that's certainly not what is part of the acceptable literary class. Still, we have a hangover from a time where people who wrote poetry should be people who are aristocrats, like Shelley, like Lord Byron, etc., etc. Somebody like Keats, who was born in a tavern, should not be writing poetry. Of course, the obvious answer, if you're quick off the mark, is to say, Jesus Christ was born in a tavern, what are you talking about? But that's another question. That was in 1795. In 1802, when he was seven, his brother Edward died. In 1804, when he was nine, his father died after falling off a horse. Horses are dangerous things, people. Be careful with it. His mother remarried very quickly in the same year and left the children in the care of their grandparents. So the children effectively lost their mother and their father in the same year, Keats being something like 9 years old. The next year, the grandfather dies. So the new substitute parental bond is broken. In 1810, when Keats was 14, 10, and 15, his mother returned and then died of tuberculosis. Just to re-establish the connection, and then she died of tuberculosis. John, at this time, was quite problematic at school, wonder why, and was frequently involved in fights, and suffered also from anxiety attacks. So we're talking about quite a difficult childhood, shall we say. At the age of 11, he had to leave school and became an apprentice surgeon. What being an apprentice surgeon means is basically you receive dead bodies which have been stolen from cemeteries and you clean them up, making them ready for the surgeon to practice operating on. Awful lot of holding down people's limbs while they're being cut off, etc., etc. So if you are a sensitive young man, a sensitive teenager who has lost most of his family through all of the endemic diseases they have at the time, probably the worst choice of apprenticeship would be the apprenticeship to being a surgeon. But anyway, that's what he does. So daily he is involved in cutting up dead bodies in different states of putrefaction. In 1814, he decides to become a poet. And just to celebrate the fact his grandmother dies. 1815, he becomes a student in Guy's Hospital, more surgery, more cutting up of dead bodies, blah, blah, blah. In 1816, he gets a qualification as an apothecary. How do you say it in Spanish? Apothecary in English. That sounds better, right. His first poems are published. His poems are viciously criticized, more because of his class than because of the poetry in themselves. He has no place, this young man who was born in the tavern writing poetry. Who does he think he is? So it's not a question of, is this poetry good or bad? It's just, you should be writing poetry. In 1818, his brother Tom dies of tuberculosis. And he meets Fanny Braun. Fanny Braun is the girl in the film Bright Star. Have you seen the film Bright Star by Jane Campion? Which is about Keats's romance with Fanny Braun. It's jolly good if you get a chance to see it, so do try to see it. And you get quite a lot of the poems, some of the poems that we'll be studying, are read in the film, as well as poems like Bright Star. In 1819, he writes all of the poems that we're interested in here. All of his great odes. And by this time, he knows that he has. tuberculosis, and both from his medical knowledge and nursing his brothers and his mother, etc., 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 he knows exactly what is going to happen to him over the coming months. In 1820, his friends, through encouragement and collecting money, and others, sent him to Italy because there's quite a lot of people who go to Italy when they get tuberculosis because the warmer weather and the drier weather is better than staying in February. and he starts suffering severe hemorrhaging from tuberculosis. That was earlier. He leaves for Italy in September. He sees that he has started a hemorrhaging, and he dies in Italy in Rome in February 1821, aged 25. Not a particularly happy life. Quite possibly the greatest poet in the English language. Certainly, if he had been allowed to live to 50, he would almost certainly have become the greatest poet in English language. But in terms of the quality of his work produced in his early 20s, nobody can hold a candle to him. And he did. But his feeling was that he hadn't actually got to that stage, and so his poetry was written on water, and the expression he used, and would just disappear. If you go to Rome, wonderful place, besides the Escalera Española, that is called there is the first building to the right of the stairs of the Escalanapa is the Keats Museum, which is where he spent the last months of his life. And there are some very nice old English ladies with lots of little dogs who keep everything as it was when he died. And you can have long conversations with them. They love talking about Keats. And there's actually a lot of English poetry things to do in Rome, if you're inclined that way. You can also go and visit Keats' grave, which is very close to Shelley's grave, which is both close to Trevelyan's grave, which is close to Shelley's son's grave, etc., etc. There is the Protestant cemetery in Rome, which is just outside the city walls. Obviously, Protestants could not be buried in the eternal city, but there is a beautiful, beautiful, lovely cemetery. And it's not what was happening in Italy, in Rome, was not what was happening in Spain. If English people died in the late 18th century, very beginning of the 19th century in Spain, they were buried at low tide on the beach with their heads looking out to sea. So they were not buried in sacred Catholic territory, being Protestant. At just about this time, they started to invent Protestant cemeteries. There's a Protestant cemetery in Extremadura, probably. There's a Protestant cemetery in Galicia, full of the Protestant sailors who died on the Costa de la Muerte, etc., etc. But until then, the people like me were buried. So with your head sticking out of the sand, looking, so you can find anything on a Spanish beach, English head, and I've been running back. But a very amusing interpretation of what is Spain, what is not Spain, because at low tide, this is underwater, it's no longer Spain, so you can bury a Protestant there. Fascinating mentality. But the Protestant cemetery in Rome is, as I said, immaculately kept, really beautiful. It's got to be quite a lot of visitors because it has famous people buried in it. And it's right beside this enormous pyramid. You know about this pyramid? There's a pyramid in Rome, a huge Roman pyramid. And what happened was one of the Roman governors of Egypt when he came back to Rome, very rich, he brought quite a large number of Egyptian slaves with him. And when he died, he declared all of his slaves free. And so these slaves, to say thank you to him for giving them freedom, built a pyramid to celebrate him. But it's a huge, very big thing. I mean, it's not a pyramid in Egypt thing, but I mean, it is an enormous construction. And it's right beside the Protestant cemetery. I don't know if there was any reason for this, but there's rather a nice story behind that. This is grateful slaves who've been freed, etc., etc., etc. So, as I said, if you are in Rome, and it's exactly where you catch the train to go to Ostia. You know Ostia? No, not Austria. Ostia. Ostia was the port, the Roman port of for Rome, but it was filled up with silt, so basically the town was abandoned. And so you can see very, very much a normal Roman town intact. All of the walls and everything is there because it was abandoned because it was no longer on the coast, so it was no use because the coast receded a couple of kilometres outwards. But if you're interested in Roman history, it's very, very, it's, in one sense, it's much more of a real place than Pompeii. And it's obviously very convenient because it's very close to Rome. So, I've planned your holidays for you. Off you go. Another example of the whole tuberculosis thing. There's a guy called Wraith in Portrait of a Lady by Henry James. Nicole Kidman, all right, yeah. You have there the typical Englishman living in Italy because he has tuberculosis and he's gone there because to make his life a bit longer. Whether you want to make your life a bit longer with tuberculosis, I don't know, but that's another question. But that type of situation was relatively common. And as a result of all of this, we have a situation where Keats is rather obsessed with I hate it when it doesn't appear. The letters don't appear until it should be a U. I don't know how that would be. Doesn't write properly. Huh? Ale, which is meant to be a U. Ale fugaces. Do you know the expression in Latin? Right. Well, it's an expression in Latin. And it is an expression which I believe comes from Horace. Horatio, and it's the decay suffered by all living things. Anything that is alive, by its nature, also is decomposing. Given the fact that Keats has seen all of these people dying of tuberculosis, and sort of these dead bodies that he's had to clean and cut up and this sort of thing, it's relatively understandable that this is one of his obsessions. Sorry, not Horatio, Ovidio. That is one of the things that he is interested in. But we have also a number of other typical romantic subjects. What is the meaning of life in a godless universe? If you have a universe where God either doesn't exist or is remote, is not intervening very much, and if God is intervening in the life of Keats, well, it would be interesting to know exactly where. Can nature serve as a substitute for God? Now, we will see this type of analysis the conclusion of it, if you like, in Gerald Manley Hopkins, the last class of the year, where Gerald Manley Hopkins, as a Jesuit, takes up these romantic ideas but sees God through nature. The romantics basically are looking at nature as an alternative to God because they don't see God, as it were. Can art and poetry be the basis of a new religion? How does the mind work? What are the limits of reality? How does drug abuse relate to the previous questions? And how can the imagination protect us against an increasingly mechanized, materialistic world? One thing I could have mentioned previously. In one sense, tuberculosis was considered quite sexy. Why? Yeah. People began to look a little bit like sort of alabaster sculptures. They would become very, very white. Their skin would become almost translucent from loss of blood. So you have a situation where people are losing their lives, but are also, in some sense, becoming perfect, sculpture-like, etc., etc. In Victorian High, in Victorian novels, people die of tuberculosis. People do not die of cholera. Cholera is nasty liquids coming out of all of the orifices of your body. There can be nothing poetic about it. So diseases are very carefully chosen in Victorian literature, etc. You can't have your hero or your heroine dying of cholera because that's just ugly. Whereas if they're dying of tuberculosis. And of course, tuberculosis also fits in quite well with the the vampire myth. You have people with, you know, blood, coughing up blood on the corners of their mouths, etc., at the same time as they're becoming more and more pallid, more and more vampire-like. So there's all that. Now, before we start talking about To Autumn, wonderful poem, there's one more concept which you have to understand. And this is the most important philosophical, artistic concept, certainly related to Keats, and probably of the Romantic age. And that concept is negative capacity. Almost there. So negative capability. What is negative capability? That could be related to it, but it's not really that. That's not the central idea of negative capability. That might be true for some. But that's not, the romantics are very, a lot of it is me. For example, Ode to the Nightingale, it's still quite a lot of me in there. By Keats. Keats manages to overcome that, but that's not exactly negative capability. Yeah? Well, there's lots of definitions, and I'm going to give you a whole load of them so you can get a feel for the wholeness of the thing. I'm just reading out to you. A concept which prizes intuition and uncertainty above reason and knowledge. So, you have the idea increasingly that it is important to deal with facts, and mysteries make you nervous as part of our modern age, we want things to be tied down. We don't like mystery. We want to know the truth. There's one objective truth, and that's it. Negative capability is part of it is enjoying the mystery, enjoying things that are not fully solved in that sense. It is open-mindedness, willingness to accept other alternatives and not have that single concept. The ability to contemplate the world without the desire to try to reconcile its contradictory aspects or fit it into a closed and rational system. Again, the modern world tries to understand everything. We have what's called the God of the Gaps. Do you understand the God of the Gaps? There is a sort of idea coming from the 19th century that we can explain scientifically more and more, and anything we can't explain, we'll have God in that. But God becomes smaller and smaller and smaller as science understands more and more of the world, and obviously as God becomes smaller, God becomes more distant. And so that mystery as part of religion becomes more and more lost in the modern, mechanized, materialistic world. It's an enjoyment of the mystery, and the belief in the mystery is negative capability. Negative capability is not a negative thing. Yeah? A little bit like the pathetic fallacy, it sounds bad, it's not bad. That is what the poet is trying to get. An acceptance of free association of ideas without rationalizing. So, things are connected by the brain, and you don't have to think, now the connection has to be because of this. Yeah? Things are connected in dream, things are connected in the subconscious, things are connected by euphony and non-rational processes. But that doesn't make their connection any less valid than things that are connected by rational processes. Okay? Similarly, an acceptance of an insight into beauty without rationalization. You can understand something that helps takes you closer to finding something aesthetically pleasing without necessarily having to go through the process of rationalizing it. Often when you rationalize it, you kill it. Okay? An ability to remain content with half knowledge. So, again, mystery is not a cause of frustration, it's a cause of wonder, it's a cause of pleasure. The capacity to forget one's own personality, this is closer to what you were saying, and enter imaginatively into the existence of others and other kinds of existence. So I can feel at one with birds and insects and apples. Yeah? That is an alternative existence. In one sense, I will never be able to understand how an insect sees the world, but I can feel with the insect. Okay? There's not a rational understanding. Thank you. Why are there two? Oh, that's the spare copies. Yes, right. You have a copy. You have a copy of the poem. Good. Okay, then. The ability to let poetry be suggestive rather than conclusive. Again, this to some extent links back to what we saw with Blake. You throw up questions so that you get people thinking, you don't tell them what to think. Thinking is your responsibility, dear reader, not my responsibility for you as poet. Negative capability gives the imagination the ability to search out mysteries, doubts, and uncertainties without transforming them into the opposite, solutions assurance and certainty. You look for mystery, but you look for mystery because mystery is interesting and pleasurable in itself without necessarily having to see mystery as a problem to be solved. A lot of what we're talking about is also archetypically, even stereotypically, allowing yourself more feminine values. Masculine values tend to be, I want to solve problems, rather than I want to air problems. I want to categorize and control, rather than allow things to happen and enjoy things as they are. So there is an element, you could say, of the romantic poet, and especially Keats, getting in touch with his feminine side. It is this half-light that poetry and the mystery of poetry, in this half-light between understanding and non-understanding, in which poetry and the mysteries of poetry reside. The ability to explore this half-life is what Keats consistently praised in Shakespeare. Shakespeare is interested in throwing up these questions and looking at his mysteries without necessarily solving them. Is there any relevance of negative capability today? Or is this just some wacky idea from the beginning of the 19th century? It is vital that you get in touch with your negative capability. Ian McGilchrist wrote a brilliant book called The Master and His Emissary in 2009. Part of the metaphorical structure of this book comes from William Blake and the idea of the struggle between the between reason and the imagination, and explores modern neurology and modern neuroscience through Blake's structures, as it were. And what McGilchrist basically is arguing, his philosophical point, is that we're in a world which is increasingly dominated by the left hemisphere, and the right hemisphere of the brain is being increasingly marginalized. And what that means is that there is a society where knowledge is based on concrete facts, and any wisdom that is based on myth or on metaphor or on experience tends to be marginalized and rejected. But we want scientific fact rather than the experience of millennia of the species, which tends to be encapsulated in literature, in poetry, and in these things. Mechanical values of quantity, speed, and precision, productivity, would replace the human values of experience. We judge the success of our society in terms of productivity. Why? Not really very clear. We don't judge it in terms of, generally speaking, of human happiness, because this is just productivity for productivity's sake. Absolutely meaningless measure for society. The quality of life and productivity have absolutely no relationship at all. The material, stuff, possessiones, in English, locally we call stuff, become the most important things in people's lives, more important than living lives. There is an increasing intolerance of ambiguity and an emphasis on certainty. Spirituality becomes reduced to following the rules imposed by a religious hierarchy rather than enjoying the wonder of what we don't understand and what is sublime. Religion is about following a series of actions rather than wondering at the immensity of the universe, etc. Art is characterized by a bizarre mix of extreme cynicism and extreme gullibility. So, you have a situation where a stenciled picture is sold for £1,400,000. It then goes into a shredding machine, what Banksy did last year. Instantly, people think it is now worthless, and then 10 minutes later, it is worth more than the original price because it has become so famous through the news. Yeah? And so, you know, it's being, this shredded picture is now being shown in galleries across Europe because it's much more famous now. I mean, Banksy must be turning in his grave, if you like, because even this ability to show up the ridiculousness of the world of art becomes commercialized and increases the value of the thing. It's, I mean, it's so crazy where we are with that. We're in a situation where an emotional response to art is something which is ridiculed, but putting a price tag on art is something which is valued, and that's how we see art. Art is an investment rather than an expression of emotion. And all of that accompanied by a mental health epidemic beyond the experience of any human society in history, certainly in Britain and North America. I don't know if it's quite as bad in Southern Europe, but the level of mental illness, both in terms of diagnosis and in terms of just people suffering in Britain, certainly in certain parts of Britain, the Manchester area, you know, absolutely crazy, a complete epidemic of mental illness. And this, for McGilchrist, is part of this increasing dominion of the left hemisphere, what Blake associated with these. So, right against these things, people go out and fight, and these things are bad. So, there we are. Right, and that brings us to autumn. Can anybody tell me anything interesting about the name of the book? The name of the poem. What is the name of the poem? Can anybody tell me anything interesting about the name of the poem? Okay. You're now talking about the first verse, the first line, not the name of the poem. What's the difference between this and the other great odes? Ode to melancholy, ode to a nightingale, ode to a Grecian urn. It doesn't say ode. Good! It doesn't say ode. It's not ode to autumn, it's to autumn. So what? What can you tell me about those two words? Can you tell me anything about those two words? Talk to me about the two words in the title. Correct. Okay. Interesting, okay. I'm more interested initially in two than in autumn. Sorry, I've decided to change. Imagine a horrendous idea, but imagine just for a second that Keats, instead of being English, was American. It would be called To Fall. And talk to me about that title, To Fall. Certainly if we translate into Spanish, it would be a substantivization of the verb. So it would be caerse. Can it mean, if our American Keats were to say, ode to fall, can it still be, can it still be an infinitive? If ode to fall, could that be an infinitive? If the title is Ode to Fall, then we have one interpretation. But if we have To Fall, it could be in Caerse or Oda a la Tonda. So we have go over that. Okay? Fine, wonderful. Fortunately, Keats is not American, Keats is English. Is there a verb to autumn? No. Was there a verb to autumn? Yes. In the Oxford English Dictionary, first recorded in 1771, so 20 years before Keats was actually born, we have the verb to autumn, which comes from autumnare in Latin, and it means to ripen, madurarse, or to bring maturity. Now, if Keats has bothered to say, ode to melancholy, ode to a nightingale, ode to a Grecian vase. I think there is another one, but I can't remember it. But says, to autumn, there's probably a reason why he hasn't said, ode to autumn. And it's probably he is enjoying that ambiguity. Remember, ambiguity, especially for the romantics, good thing. Yeah? Ambiguity for you with all of your left brain stuff, bad thing. Ambiguity for these people, good thing. It resonates. It makes you think about the thing. So there's this idea of madurarse. It's not American. It's not caerse. Yeah? It's not to fall. By the way, if any pompous British person ever complains to you about somebody saying fall instead of autumn, you can tell them that fall is recorded in the English language earlier than autumn. Autumn is the French import, and fall was maintained in English in America quite correctly. It's not a case of the American word being more modern at all. The American word is, in fact, more ancient than that, in that case. But anyway, it's not to fall, it is to autumn. The idea of life. So, it is perfectly reasonable. We have the word being used before Keats was born. It was definitely current when Keats was alive to have to autumn as a verbal sense, as a verb being used as a noun. Why am I talking about as a verb being used as a noun? The evidence is in front of you. The truth is out there. X-Fact. Yeah? Look at the paper. Yes, Does that answer my question? Okay, thank you, but not relevant. Why am I, your teacher, emphasizing the fact that this is a verb being used as a noun? Okay, I will ask you another question. €20 for the first person to identify an active verb in the first stanza. It's a joke, isn't it? Ah, there isn't one, right. So, what we have in the first paragraph, in the first stanza, and throughout the poem largely, is inactive verbs. What is different about an infinitive? What does an infinitive suggest? I took it in a number. The infinite. No, the opposite. It's not ephemeral. It's infinite. The infinitive suggests completion. That's why it's called the infinitive. There's no finite process about it. He is suggesting the stasis of the moment, the fact that this is a non-progression. This is a situation of stasis. Lived while you are living with it is a situation of stasis. So, although the natural world is involved in the passing of seasons and eventually death, nature has inbuilt mechanisms that ensure the continuity of beauty from season to season, from year to year. In one sense, we are going back, or if you like, forward, to Tennyson and this whole idea that I've gone on here again and again about nature. Red nature, red, ungara y viento, this. I think it's an idea, isn't it? No? Green nature, thing related to the vegetable cycle, regeneration, etc., etc. Red nature, the nature of carnivores, of people, of the individual, dies. Yeah? But green nature continues. Now, in a lot of cases, Keats will extend green nature. Keats will extend green nature to insects, to birds, because you have the same bird song. We have the same situations regenerated. Even if the individual bird dies, there is that process of regeneration. I think they've gone. So, as you now have said several times, Keats's speaker begins by addressing autumn and describing its abundance and its intimacy with the sun, with whom autumn ripens fruit and causes late flowers to bloom. So, the whole process, if you like, of the year so far, and of course we have this idea of comparing year with human life, culminates in this moment of abundance. Do you have harvest festivals in Spain? As you know, in Britain we're sort of medio parano, really. And we have all of these pagan festivals that are incorporated into pretend Christianity, into real Christianity. And one of the things that happens in Britain is you will have, there is a festival where traditionally crops were brought into the church and were blessed. And people bring food into the church, and there's a collection of food, etc., which is distributed amongst the poor people and this sort of thing. And it's part of a celebration of abundance of cornucopia, etc. And I can't remember the exact date, but it's certainly an autumn festival. So, in the point where autumn is, yes, the days are closing in, Yes, it's not as hot as in summer, but yes, it is the moment of abundance. It's the moment where fruit is ripe and all this type of thing. This is Keats connecting with that moment in his life. And Keats going beyond the process of saying, why is it that everything that's beautiful putrefies? Why is it that everything that's beautiful dies? Why is it that things which are beautiful that don't die, don't live? And accepting death, but at the same time, through accepting death, being able to live this moment of fullness. So, in the same sense as somebody describes death, you can find out, this is your homework, find out, as the silver paint on the back of a mirror. Okay? Mirror is a piece of glass with silver paint on it. And you can only understand life through the existence of death. Without death, life is meaningless. So, Shelley is going on and on about how I'm a poet and how we need revolutionary change, and a little bit, I'm going to live forever. Keats is in the situation of, he doesn't, of course, but he doesn't know he's not going to. Shelley is expecting to live till he's 80. He just happens to die in a storm at sea. Keats knows full well at this time that he's going to die. He's already started coughing up blood, and he knows exactly what that means. Yeah? This is not a bad case of the flu or anything else. He knows exactly the symptoms of tuberculosis because he's nursed 3 or 4 members of his family with tuberculosis. Yeah? No, there's no mystery in tuberculosis for him. He knows where he is. And where he is in a moment where he could say, okay, I accept, I'm going to die, but I'm going to enjoy this moment. And it's that intensity of the situation which turns this into what Harold Bloom, who you all love and respect, calls as close to perfect as any short poem in the English language. Basically says, this is the most perfect short poem in the English language. You have to appreciate it. You have to be nice about it. Otherwise, Harold Bloom will come and visit you. And you don't want that. So, this is such a time of plenty that the bees think that this Indian summer will last forever. Do you understand Indian summer? What's an Indian summer? Yeah? Indian summer is a very, very common expression both in British English and American English. I didn't actually know this, but its origins are in American English. The summer tended to carry on later in the Indian territories, so in the center of the United States nowadays, than on the East Coast, because of course the East Coast is affected by the Gulf Stream, so it's been cooled down constantly by a cold sea coming from the Arctic. So winter starts earlier in the East Coast than in the Indian territories, or the Native American territories, as they were at a particular point in history. And so our veranito de San Miguel, or veranito de Mao, or veranito de la Perfecta, is what we call an Indian summer. Yeah? And so he is in that situation. This is when autumn officially has begun. But we have one of those wonderful days where it's not too hot, never too hot in the winter. It's not too hot, but we have beautiful, glorious sunny day, and you have this abundance, this cornucopia of abundance, that is what he is appreciating. He's appreciating this moment, not because he has lots of stress in his life until he needs to go to a mindfulness class, but because he knows that over the coming months, he is going to cough up his lungs until he's dead. And he is allowing himself this moment of pleasure. That's where we are. Okay. By implication,
humans know, so we've got a situation where the bees, as insects, are in a situation where they think that this abundance will go on forever. Yeah? Their hive is full of honey. There's nothing, they can't put any more honey into the hive. It's just, they've had this period of abundance, and because they are bees, they have no notion of future and past and death and all these types of things, unlike Shelley Skylab, who was a mind reader, very, very intelligent. These bees know nothing of these things, and so in their innocence, they can enjoy this moment in a way that's much more difficult for humans to enjoy. So we tend to think, we tend to be in Game of Thrones moment of winter is coming, and so we destroy our ability to enjoy this time. And there is to some extent in the Veraneo of San Miguel is God is hot again a little bit, yes, but in Britain that moment of cloudless skies, still relatively long days, etc., etc., before what is winter. I mean, winter in Britain is not the, at least part alivio that it is in Spain. Yeah? At least, you know, when you get to your 2 days of autumn and then winter starts in Madrid, there is an element we survived the heat of the summer. That is not the emotion. The emotion is very different in the English context. It is this last moment of abundance before raining every day, a little bit of rain every day, not storms like yesterday, but just a little bit of rain every day. Everything is sort of damp, especially pre-central heating, etc., etc. A part of the population dies in winter. People who have tuberculosis who stay in Britain die. Yeah? It's not, we live in a de-seasoned society. We don't have the idea that it's this time of year, so I'm eating abas. It's this time of year, so I'm eating alcatraz. It's this time of year, so I'm eating tomatoes. We eat tomatoes all year round. We eat abas, even if they're frozen, all year round. We eat artichokes all year round. Because we don't have our relationship with nature is different. Society. But we have to try and put ourselves into, as well as all of this mindfulness, put ourselves into that mindset. So, in the second stanza, the speaker describes the figure of autumn as a female goddess adopting the ways of country folk in high autumn. So you have this intense period of activity. All the children are on holiday. Why is there such a long holiday in the summer? Why are school holidays 3 months, 3 months, 3.5 months long? Do children need to stop studying for 3.5 months for their mental health? No. Do teachers need to stop working, to stop dealing with other people's children for 3.5 months for their mental health? Possibly. That's a different question. Now, the reason that we have the summer holidays that we have is because traditionally, from the late 19th century to the mid-20th century, children helped with the harvest. Children were sent to the countryside to help. There was a need for that extra labor. Now you have people coming from Morocco, etc., etc., etc. You have machines, you have blah, 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 blah. But that's the reason we have these ridiculous holidays. Yeah? And we still have them. Why? It's crazy. We give a quarter of the year to children as teachers. It depends also the nature of things. Yeah, but if most homes and all offices can have air conditioning. You can have air conditioning in the school. Well, okay. You have arguments against this. But what you create is the perfect condition for children to forget everything they've learned, if you have intensive learning for 9 months or 8.5 months and just holidays for 3.5 months. When you're teaching a language, you've done very well with it. You're teaching the same nonsense every year. It's been wonderful. It means that I will never be unemployed instead. Yeah? Because you give yourself all of this time to forget what you've learned, and so we're taking 4 steps forward, 3 steps back. 4 steps forward, 3 steps back. It's not surprising that most people hate English. Because they're learning stuff, giving themselves just enough time to forget it, and then learning the same stuff again. You have all learnt the first conditional, or you've all learnt the present perfect 12 times at least, or not. Crazy to have this structure. Okay, maybe we need fans, or a better type of air conditioning, or different things where children are having classes in creativity and critical thinking and things like that. But it's a nightmare for Spanish parents in the West, to have their children at home for 3.5 months. The economy doesn't work properly. Something must be changed with that. It just makes no sense at all. And the reason for it is related to the 19th century, not to the 21st century. Anyway. So, you have this situation where you have this intense activity, all of these children coming out of the cities, or all of these children being employed, everybody helping out, men, women, children. Harvest is pre-industrial. We don't have a big combine harvest of one man on that machine gun. You have lots of people involved, everybody doing their little bit to get the harvest in. Most of the society being involved. Leave it out too long, it can get rained on, there can be a storm, there can be a frost. Intense activity. Really quite an insect-like activity. Yeah? In the same way as you would tend to use ants as a symbol of industriousness, there's that sort of level of activity. And it's finished. The harvest is in. And so you have this moment where this rural woman, the goddess Autumn personified, can just lie back in the harvest room, in the threshing room, and her hair is played with by the breeze. It's not a wind, it's a breeze. Yeah? And it's just peace, it's just relaxation. This is the moment of breathing. This moment of relaxation after this intense activity. She can relax now that the harvest is in, and is often seen seated on the granary floor, her hair soft lifted by the wind, and often seen sleeping in the fields or watching a cider press squeezing the juice from apples. So, again, what we are used to is machines, instant, blah. Machines are all about productivity, do things in the instant. There's a much more interesting type of pre-industrial machine, which is a press. Press is a classic pre-industrial machine. We think in terms of the printing press. But the printing press was inspired by the fruit press. Gutenberg saw a fruit press and thought, ooh, I can do that with letters. Yeah? It's true. That is the way that it was generated. And so, this idea of the press is slow and constant pressure. If you suddenly just sort of have some immense weight on a load of apples, yeah? I don't know what's going to happen. The thing will explode or something, I don't know. What you have in a fruit press is a heavy weight, and the juice comes out very slowly. Very slowly comes out. There's a cumulative slow process. It's exactly the same process which Gerard Manley Hopkins, the greatest poet ever, compares, as we will see, with the olive press. And he says the olive press is like the glory of God. You have this beautiful golden thing coming out slowly, 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 being generated by a press. God's glory is like that. You instantly become a Christian when you read Gerald Manley Hopkins' wonderful, as you will see. So there is that connection between these two, and you might just possibly be able to create that connection of the press between Gerald Manley Hopkins, God's Glory, and Two Lords. So the atmosphere is soporific, and human activities are at one with nature. We don't have humanity antagonistic towards nature. We have human activities. The pace of nature coincides perfectly with human ambitions. Human ambition after the harvest is just to relax and enjoy the sun while it's there. It's a longish, slow day, and that's exactly what you want after a lot of hard work. Notice how the fruit of the first stanza has been processed into this in the second stanza. It's possible to sort of see this as three separate poems. It's not three separate poems, it is one poem, and thematically it links from one to the other, and also symbolically in this type of thing. So, we have three different parts of the day, from midday through to dusk, at the end of the day. We have the process through the year. So what is late summer, transition to autumn, to the end of autumn and the coming of winter. And through these, all of these natural elements that have been described. In the third stanza, the speaker tells autumn not to wonder where the songs of spring have gone, but instead to listen to our own music. Yes, spring is glorious, spring is wonderful, you have all of the buds out, you have all of the cherry trees, I've got all of the cherry trees in Madrid, beautiful, wonderful fuchsias and everything, and pink and all of these colours, beautiful. But autumn has its own beauty. Yeah? Obviously, very, very obviously in places like Maine, where all of those pictures you see of the golden brown and green and the golden leaves you have in places like Maine. But in general, generally, where you have an autumn, unfortunately in Madrid there's no autumn. This morning it's summer and this afternoon it's winter, and that's it. Goodbye. But in places where there are, at least there used to be four seasons, you have that situation. In the third stanza, the focus is on the air and on auditory stimuli. So again, there's elements of synesthesia, but it's much more compact and much more harmonically related. At twilight, the small gnats, do you understand gnats? Gnats. Gnats. Not gnats. Gnats. No, not gnats. No. Not gnats. Gnats. G-N-A-T. A gnat. Yeah. They're a little bit like mosquitoes in the sense that they're very little insects, but they tend to be in groups, and they don't, they're annoying because they get in your face, etc., but they don't attack you, they don't bite you or sting you. Yeah? They're just sort of there. And so the small gnats come among the river swallows and the willow trees, lifted and dropped by the wind. So they tend to be sort of in groups and they tend to sort of move around with the breeze. The full-grown lambs leap from the hills. So they've got through the process of the lambs being tiny little lambs, they're now small sheep. Crickets sing. You understand crickets? Yes, right. And robins whistle from the gardens, and swallows gather for the coming migration, singing from the stars. So unlike humans, the bees, and all these other animals, generally speaking, are blessed with an ignorance about winter, but not the swallow. The swallows are rather like the nightingale in the previous poem, that they do fly away, and by flying away, they break the moon. The swallows are a symbol of migration, and therefore a symbol of this moment will not last forever. That there is an element of nature which is conscious this will not last forever, and that this moment will end. But there is also this idea of Keats having overcome the trauma of knowing that he's going to die and making his peace with death. So, in an earlier poem on the grasshopper and the cricket, Keats had stated that the poetry of the earth is never dead. The poetry, the natural poetry, the poetry of nature will always continue. And Keats likened the song of the insects to the clamour of poets. So there's some idea here that there is a potential for him to continue, for him to survive. This is, bye-bye, this is therefore a valedictory poem. Do you remember what a valedictory poem is? You don't have to know because you haven't studied Donne. You haven't studied Donne. They should know because they have studied Donne. No, that's an albade. An albade or an alba. Now, victory poem is bye-bye. So this is Keats saying farewell to poetry. And basically saying farewell to life. Yeah? He has this idea this is going to be his last English summer. He's now going to spend the winter in Italy, but he's also probably pretty conscious that even spending the winter in Italy is not going to stop the progress of tuberculosis. The only thing he needs to stop the process of tuberculosis is penicillin, and that's not around for another 80 years. So he knows he's going to die. This is the end of his summer. The rest is the clock. But he can now finally appreciate it. So what we have also here is the fusion and the summation of Carpe Diem and in Memento Mori. We can be conscious of and accept death, and through that enjoy the moment, seize the moment of life. So he brings the two things together and manages to reconcile them through this concept of the moment. He knows that he wouldn't be able to enjoy the moment in a situation of immortality, because immortality necessarily demands stasis. And stasis is not living. Stasis is death. Okay? It is now pretty much time, but there is one further interpretation it's quite a lot more of that, so do read this. But one thing that you could also understand is that this probably was the first normal summer after Mount Tambora's explosion and the process of the summer without, a year without a summer, and all of these atmospheric effects. Finally, the natural order has been restored. Now, you could say, well, volcanoes are also part of the natural world. Yes, that's true, blah, blah, blah. But there's also an element of some critics interpret this politically and see this. We've had a situation of an increasing amount of repression in British politics. All over Europe there's been a lot of repression because of the bad harvest and things. Bread prices have been high. People have been wandering around with placards saying bread or blood, either you give us bread or we will create anarchy, blah, 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 blah. We've had the Peterloo Massacre. Are you aware of the Peterloo Massacre? There was a very, very strong movement, the Chartist movement, demanding votes for universal suffrage, demanding democracy, and in a completely peaceful demonstration of 100,000 people, I mean, like a lot of people, much more, even more peaceful than the votes in Catalonia, etc. The authorities sent in basically the same hussars or whatever, horse cavalry, to attack this peaceful demonstrating crowd, and all sorts of people were sort of cut down in a scene that you might expect in Tsarist Russia, where there's a huge shock in Britain. People did not expect the authorities to behave like that against peaceful protest. And in this year, at the time that Keats was writing, the person who was who had organized that demonstration was being tried for sedition, which carried the death penalty. And the judges declared him innocent, and basically the judges concluded the authorities made a complete mess of the situation. And that meant that there was a certain amount of hope that things in British society would get back to normal from this authoritarian state that had begun with the Napoleonic Wars. You could actually go back to some level of individual freedom and people would be able to express themselves. So this poem could also have some element of that type of political interpretation. If that were the case, then it's very interesting to compare with the clearly political side of Ode to the West Wind by Shelley. But in any case, please, people, be aware that there will be a huge temptation for the people of the thing to say, compare and contrast the Ode to the West Wind to Autumn, or compare and contrast to A Skylark to a Nightingale. It's just an obvious thing to do. So, in each case, you've only had half of that in the tutorials. You have recorded tutorials, you have the information in order to set up that. If anybody wants to do that, write that essay directly, do so, send it, fine, wonderful. If you have a situation where either of those two essays comes up in the exam, and you haven't prepared it, well, you can kick yourself, but you can't kick me, okay? I warned you. Okay, so see you next week. Next week, much later.